LinkedIn News.
Hannah, do you think of yourself as an awkward person?
I now embrace it as a quality, yes. So the answer is yes. I think of myself as a wonderfully awkward, confident person.
From the news team at LinkedIn, I'm Jesse Hempel, and this is Hello Monday. Today, we bring you the second and final episode in our short series that I've come to call How to Be Unforgettable. Last week, we explored how to be less silent. That's how I think of the conversation I had with Elaine Lynn Herring. This week, we ask you to consider being more awkward. Because if you're going to be brave enough and loud enough to make an impression, things are going to get awkward. They just are. So many awkward things happen at work. Have you ever hit reply all on an email that should never have gone out? Called a colleague by the wrong name? Spoken up in a meeting only to say something that just sounds dumb when you think about it? Once, I spent an entire client meeting with an advertiser at the magazine I used to work for, calling her Erin. So loudly, Erin, Erin. Afterwards, she pulled me over and said, "My name is Ellen." Can any of us really avoid these situations? Should we? Today's guest thinks we should lean into them. More after this.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
My guest today is Hannah Pryor. She's a workplace performance expert, a keynote speaker, and the author of the book Good Awkward. She's very much not here to help us avoid those awkward situations. She's here to help us embrace them and learn from them. Here's Hannah.
I try not to speak in absolutes, but all neurotypical people experience the emotion of awkwardness. It is universal. The most confident person we know experiences it just as often. Their comeback rate is just quicker. Their coping mechanisms are just different, but they experience it just as much as the next person.
You know, reading your book, I thought a lot about this idea that maybe awkwardness has something to teach us about how we perceive ourselves in public.
I love that you said that because I really believe that this emotion is a very powerful signal. There's so much data inside of this emotion because awkwardness is a social emotion. It's rooted in the way we feel around other people. So if I, Jesse, were sitting across from you and I mispronounce your name, that's going to create a very different emotion in me than if I was at home thinking I'm going to have a conversation with Jesse. Oh, I mispronounced her name, but nobody heard me. Yeah. Right? It's a social emotion. We feel it more in front of other people. And so that relationship between our upbringing, the stories we tell ourselves, especially as it relates to how other people perceive us, has a lot of data and informs how we show up in the world.
It's a social emotion. And also, people probably experience it differently depending on their context, right? Their upbringing, their position in the world.
Yes, I cannot agree with this more. So I personally came from South Asian descent. I'm first born in the United States. My mom is from Pakistan. My dad is from India. And the stories I was told growing up very much informed the feelings of awkwardness I carried most of my life. So in my household, there's an expression, some listeners might know this one, it's log kya kahenge, which translates to what are other people going to think? What are other people going to think? That was drilled into me. What will other people think of your choices, of your behavior, of the way you show up in the world? And so I came through my adolescence into high school, college, early professional years with a very strong care to a fault. What will other people think? Which really made it difficult for me to endure awkward or embarrassing situations.
I feel like to have grown up during the time period that we grew up, we're roughly the same vintage, is to have received kind of mixed messages from the larger culture and maybe from your family of origin as well. Both to have received the message, don't care what anybody else thinks. You go out and you be you.
Right.
But also, could you please just do things enough like everybody else that we're going to be proud of you?
Exactly. And you know, this is an important call out because the emotion of awkwardness, again, being a social emotion, it is taking into consideration that we are wired for social acceptance.
Yeah.
We are wired that way. We are tribal creatures. Our brains want to be accepted by our communities. And so it's a great idea to say, just come out there, be who you are, even if other people don't like it. Our human brain is not wired for that. That's very challenging. And so growing up, I tried like hell to assimilate. I wanted to be like everybody else. My name was Henna. I really wanted to be Jennifer or Samantha or Jessica. I was born in the early 80s, if you can't tell.
As a Jessica.
Yes.
Yeah. I will tell you that all I wanted was a name that wasn't the same name everyone else had.
Grass is always greener, right?
Yes.
Yeah, but that story of assimilation is a common one for anybody, you know, cultural or not. And we look for who we are. It's actually early adolescence, around age 8 or 9, that we start to actually experience self-consciousness, which essentially translates to we start to look for who we are through the lens of who do other people see and do they like what they see? And so all of a sudden, this little aperture widens and we're like, what are they seeing? Is this the same? Do I like this version? And we start to adjust our behavior because of that.
Yeah. Early adolescence, huh?
It's not, you know, not an absolute, but most of the time, if you think about, you know, your children, your nieces, your nephews, your neighbors who are 3, 4, 5 years old, they're not very worried about looking awkward.
Yeah.
They're just dancing in the kitchen, pantsless, arms up, you know, screaming at the top of their lungs. It doesn't matter to them because they haven't yet developed this emotion of self-consciousness as deeply as folks do as they get older. You know, I think it would be naive for us to say, oh, let's just go back to that, right? Very few of us don't operate in a team or in some sort of environment where we interact with other people. There are some exceptions. You know, astronauts tend to be isolated. Polar explorers tend to be isolated. But what's interesting is there have been studies on those folks who are more isolated, and we found that when they come back from their adventures, their escapades, that there is actually a decrease in their social muscle. They forget how to people.
Right. Well, and we are talking in 2024. And from all that I can tell, 2024 is the year that the office reassembles itself. Mm-hmm. You know, there was the pandemic, and then we've had a couple of years where some people have worked from home, some people have worked from the office. But this is the year we're going to have to learn how to people again because people are coming back.
We have to. Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. And, you know, where there's real opportunity for all of us. And, you know, sometimes people hear about the topic of awkwardness and they think, oh, Henna wrote a book for introverts. Well, let me tell you something. I am 100% extrovert. I am not an introvert. But here's what we're experiencing. This is actually even before the pandemic. We are experiencing a decrease in our social musculature. What I mean by that is technology and other kind of just changes in society have made it so we don't have to talk to people if we don't want to. So well before we were back in a hybrid or back in a remote environment, we were starting to, you know, date by swiping. We were ordering our food on the restaurant's website or on DoorDash. We've slowly been atrophying these social muscles, and just add to that the fact that there's a decline in, you know, public shared spaces. People don't spend as much time in libraries and things as they used to. You know, successful people, as they get more successful, they move to the suburbs instead of living in the big cities where they interact with folks more. There's so many reasons that these muscles start to lose their strength. And so when we come back to the office, we need to know how to do that. We need to learn how to do that.
Well, so your invitation to all of us is to figure out how to lean into the awkward things that happen. It's easy when these things happen to think, A, that you're the only person who's ever done this, B, that this is a career ender for you, and most importantly, C, that anybody actually noticed at all or perceived it to be awkward in the same way that you perceived it to be.
Yeah, most people run that through that sequence of three, you know, completely run through that sequence. And the C is the important one, is even if they noticed, one of the best pieces of research that comes out of this is, you know, A, they're not noticing with nearly the intensity that you think, with something called the illusion of transparency. We think, oh God, they can see me sweating. They can see how red my face is. They can see that I'm visibly mortified. Sometimes, rarely, can they see it the way you feel that it's coming across. It's rare that they can see it to that intensity. And then, of course, Tom Gilovich out of Cornell, his, you know, research on the spotlight effect, they may have noticed, but guess what? They stopped paying attention ages ago. People are not analyzing you with the depth and intensity that you think they are, because guess what? Within seconds, they're already worried, well, what about me?
Yes.
What am I going to say next? What awkward thing am I about to do? They've already moved on. And that's, it's freeing once we realize that.
We're going to take a quick break here. Stick around. And if you like the show, sign up for our newsletter at linkedin.com/HelloMonday. That's linkedin.com/HelloMonday. We'll drop career advice and episode highlights into your inbox every Monday.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise. A promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. A promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
And we're back. So in the first half of this conversation, Henna makes it pretty clear that most people do not notice our awkward moments, at least not as intensely as we think they might. But knowing that on its own isn't enough to get us to really embrace that awkwardness. That takes a little more effort. To walk us through this, once again, here's Henna.
Really, embracing awkwardness is a two-part effort. It's first in the mindset side of things, and then second in the sort of active conditioning side of things. On the mindset side of things, one of the favorite techniques I have around this is actually slowing down after an awkward interaction and doing a bit of a retroactive. What actually happened there? What am I feeling? And so my favorite research comes out of Northwestern University. Dan McAdams talks about contamination stories versus redemption stories. So after an awkward situation or an embarrassing moment, do you tell yourself a contamination story? For example, I raise my hand in the meeting. I shared an idea. The boss says, no, that's a terrible idea. That's not going to fly. Do I take that and go, I should never raise my hand in a meeting ever again? You idiot. Why would you say such a thing? That experience now contaminates the future. You won't raise your hand again. It's going to freeze you from trying the thing the next time. Versus instead, you can tell yourself a redemptive story, which is, you know, I don't typically raise my hand in these meetings, and I tried something. It didn't quite go how I planned, but it's looking for the gifts in the garbage. I'm going to give myself a point for that. I'm going to give myself a star. A favorite example is Lena Nair from Unilever used to give herself on a piece of paper with her pen stars every time she spoke up in a meeting, no matter how it was received. Right. No matter how it went, because what she was trying to condition and celebrate was, I tried it. I want to tell myself a different story about these experiences. So that's sort of part one, the mindset part.
Right. It's like such a reminder that we choose to tell ourselves the stories we choose to tell ourselves. And also a reminder that we can rewrite them, too. That they don't have to be static.
Right. Our brains remember standout events, right? It's not going to remember the little tiny things that were not consequential. And I think what's important about this is the realization that we can't choose our first thought. Our first thought might be, oh God, I'm mortified.
Yes.
Oh my God, I'm an idiot. We can't choose our first thought, but we can slow down long enough to choose our second. So it's not about not feeling the emotion. You're going to. You're human. It's about not getting hooked by the emotion. It's about having a strategy to let it unhook so that you can continue to move forward towards your growth.
Indulge me in this a second, Henna.
Yeah.
Like, you have branded yourself an awkward person, and I don't mean just because you have written this book. You write about yourself in this book as though you knew about yourself and announced to the world previous to this book, I am an awkward person. And there is a way in which what that does is it makes the environment psychologically safer for the people around you so that they can lean into their awkwardness as well. And I thought that that was like an interesting way in which your awkwardness served to further your leadership.
Yeah, nobody's ever framed it that way before, but I do love that because there's power in normalizing what so many people perceive as a deficiency.
Yeah.
You know, I think most people hear this word and they think this is a weakness to fix. This is a deficiency to fix. If I feel it, I'm an imposter. I'm not capable. And I try to be very clear early on that awkwardness is not ineptitude.
Right.
Awkwardness is not a lack of skill or inability or lack of being able to be in a room. It is an emotion. It's an emotion. And so I think it's powerful to name that as a marker of who you are, but if and only if you can claim that in a way that serves you. So I can call myself awkward confident, but I can lean into it as something that feels good. Now, if you call yourself an awkward person and that holds you back, that's different, right? Then we need to reevaluate the way you're using that term to describe yourself because it's a box of your own creation.
Yeah. Do men and women experience awkwardness differently?
They do. So there's, you know, a systemic component to this that I think we'd be remiss not to talk about. Women still, and especially women of color, are still held to a disproportionate level of scrutiny. And often confidence needs to appear like flawlessness.
Yes.
You know, especially for women of color, sometimes these missteps, these mistakes, these blunders that we don't recover from immediately are held against us to a different level. And so this isn't a blanket thing. I think we need to test for psychological safety, as you said. What is acceptable within this organization? What do we tolerate? But more than that, it's also about recognizing the systems that we grew up in. So I'll just share an example. I loved in the book, I interviewed a man named Bob Russo out of IBM, and he shared the story about how they were in a meeting and the leader shared an anecdote that fell flat.
Yeah.
And within moments, they could feel there was tension in the room. Everyone was like, oh God, did he just say that? And the leader said, well, that just went over like a fart in church, right? And everyone immediately laughs and their shoulders drop. Now, again, he's in a power position, so he can use humor in that way to lighten the load of the room. But also what that created was because he made a mistake and owned it, because he had an awkward misstep and owned
right.
it, for the rest of the meeting, almost anyone in the room, be it, you know, a heterosexual, cisgendered Caucasian male or a woman of color, felt a little safer to say the wrong thing or to try it and have it go sideways. And so there's a real opportunity for leaders, especially for women, marginalized groups, to make it okay by modeling it themselves.
Yeah, there's an opportunity that comes with like a fear that's fair,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think like what you're saying, what I'm hearing you say is that it's okay and even important to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I think one of the coolest and funniest counterintuitive truths about the emotion of awkwardness is the avoidance of awkwardness increases awkwardness.
Oh gosh, right?
We're like, someone say something, please. Oh, this is awful. The tension in the air, the thickness is killing us all. All it takes is one person to go, oof, that was cringe, right?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, that was awkward. And all of a sudden, we all get to relax. We all get to take a deep breath. But it really helps to kind of pop that bubble of tension. And the person who does it tends to be the person we look at as, oh, that person's confident.
Yes, completely. Because you're willing to call it out.
Yes.
Right? When actually it's not that hard to call out
no.
if it's a thing that everybody knows.
Yeah, but it takes practice.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the second part. So mindset, story mm-hmm. is so important. It's the place where you begin.
Mm-hmm. The second part of this is conditioning. By this, I mean purposefully and intentionally putting yourself in situations to put in social repetitions. So again, we started to talk about this idea that increasingly the world does not require you to have in-person interaction all the time. So here's something that's true about this emotion. Awkwardness exists in uncertainty. It exists in these moments where something we expected to go like this, and instead it went like that. Embarrassment
right.
exists in the same, you know, sphere, in the same place. And so the one big downside of when we all went remote and hybrid and are not next to each other is a lot of our communication became asynchronous.
Yes.
You can reach out to someone and they don't have to respond right away. You can take a beat. You can figure out what you're going to say or what you're going to do. Now, the truth of the matter is, when we're having live conversations, we don't get those same opportunities virtually to practice what happens accidentally.
Yeah.
We don't get the same opportunities for happenstance to occur of, oh, I didn't mean to call you that. I didn't mean to do that.
Yeah.
We don't get those opportunities. And so this is why a lot of folks coming back to the office who are now interacting with teams are finding even the most mundane conversations to be challenging because they haven't had social repetitions. So when we talk about conditioning as an antidote to this, what I would suggest to people is find small, low-stakes moments to practice putting in a social rep. For example, super simply, the next time you're in a grocery store line, don't take out your phone. Just for a few minutes, don't take out your phone. Try to just catch eyes with someone and smile. You don't even have to have a full conversation the first time if you don't want to. But it's this ability to withstand social uncertainty in small doses that allows us to actually have the ability and the muscle to have a difficult conversation that requires looking someone in the eye in the big moments. But if we can't tolerate them in the small moments, the big moments are going to feel like a Herculean lift.
I tried that this morning on
Did
the subway.
You?
Totally failed.
Why?
And I don't. And I shouldn't fail. I am a person who is like, I think of myself as socially comfortable. But I got on the subway. I had like been reading your book this morning early in the morning and really enjoying it. And got on the subway and I made eye contact with a woman who was incredibly well put together.
Mm.
And she had the most amazing eyeshadow. And I felt like whatever she was going to do today, she was going to rock it. And then I was like, Jesse, Hannah would tell you to tell her that. I was like, okay, I'm going to tell her that. I have from now until 34th Street, which for our listener who doesn't live in New York City, that's about 20 minutes, right? She could get off beforehand, right? So I thought about it for a while. Mm-hmm. And then I tried to catch eyes with her again. Then I did catch eyes with her again. And she smiled a little and I smiled a little. And I thought, well, that's a good start. And then I was like, you should never compliment somebody, especially a woman, on what they look like. I don't want to be a person who does that. And then I thought, well, probably she'd think it was cool. I would think it was cool if someone said mm-hmm. that to me. I would be like, yes, I'm going to be more confident all day. And then I thought, but she might not. And then she got off the train. And there you go. There's the whole backstory right there. I practiced.
Yeah.
It didn't work.
I will disagree with you only on one front. I would not call that a fail. I would not call that a fail. So it didn't go exactly how you had imagined it. Remember, this is about expectation management to a degree.
Right.
But maybe you catching eyes and smiling at her was a step towards that growth edge. And maybe the next time you'll say something, or maybe you won't. But I think a lot of the heart of this is I want you to celebrate the proverbial putting a star on the page. You smiled at her twice and caught eyes. That makes humans feel good.
Yeah.
You might have made her day by catching her eye and smiling. And so maybe you didn't get to talk about her eyeshadow, but I still see success in that. That's the gift in the garbage of that interaction.
By finding the gifts in the garbage, as Hannah puts it, we can bring meaning to our awkward slips or half measures. We can still learn and grow. And ultimately, that's the whole point of these last couple of conversations. How we show up and how we are perceived matters so much to the trajectory of our careers, however we might feel about that. But that doesn't mean we have to fake our way through. We can instead offer connection to our true selves. We can do our best to be authentic.
I think embracing our awkwardness and or not embracing it is one of the biggest stumbling blocks or obstacles to accessing authenticity. So authenticity is what creates that connection. I don't think if I were to ask for a show of hands, who wants to be less authentic at work? That one person would raise their hands. But at the same time, I'll say, who wants to be more authentic at work and doesn't know how?
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's hand shoots up. They're like, yeah, that sounds good. That sounds great. But how do I do that?
I have a lot of trouble with the word authenticity because I feel like it doesn't leave us with a path to execution. Authenticity, like, what does it mean to be my true self or my real self? Does it mean to share a bunch of personal information? Does it mean to perform in a certain way? Well, no, it doesn't really mean either of those two things. How do you define it?
Yeah, I love what you said earlier about mixed messages, because I think this is the heart of what a lot of companies are trying to figure out. They're saying to their teams, please be authentic at work. Please bring your whole self. But also, this is our corporate culture, and this is what we agree to be as an organization, as a team. Those two things don't really go together, right?
Yeah.
And so we actually just have to be very careful and intentional and thoughtful about what do we mean by that? What do we mean when we say bring your whole self? Bring your whole self in the versions that we as an organization deem palatable, or truly bring your whole self? And I think these are challenging, nuanced things. I don't think we can simplify it in a sentence, but these are our opportunities as leaders and organizations.
I also think the definition is moving
yeah.
on that. It is actively moving. So anytime you try to harness it completely and pin it down, you are going to be reminded of the uncomfortable truth that most of our world exists in the gray. It exists
yeah.
in the process of defining, not in the definition.
I agree. I love that idea. And also just, you know, remembering that, again, coming back to this idea that we're social creatures. So
yeah.
if your authentic self is just telling people that their clothes are ugly, well, that's not going to get you very far, right?
No.
We are people who work in tandem. We collaborate with others. And so there is always going to be this tension that we straddle between bringing our whole selves, but being a harmonious member of a team, organization, family, community. This is going to be the tension, I think, of our life.
I would like to confess that I thought when you came in that you would actually bring the awkward, and you have been nothing but elegant for the past hour in the studio, and it's very confusing to me. You promised me awkward.
I snort when I laugh. I say the wrong thing constantly, and I will tell you that I laugh when people say what you're saying, because any eloquence or, you know, articulate tendencies that you see are a product of a lot of conditioning, of a lot of repetition, of a lot of rehearsing, of a lot of doing the things that feel hard for me and that make me cringe top to bottom. But there was no way around to get to this place, only through.
That was Hannah Pryor. Visit her on LinkedIn or check out her website, goodawkward.com, for more. And so grateful to be closing out our series on how to be unforgettable by talking to Henna. I have some clear steps on what to do to transform my cringiest moments. To get the gifts in the garbage, as Henna says, first. Awkwardness is a social emotion. It's going to come up when we're interacting with people, and we should still interact with people, even when we feel awkward. Second, embracing our awkwardness happens when we employ two tactics. We have to be very conscious of the story we tell ourselves about what happened. We get to choose if it's a redemptive story or not. And then we have to condition ourselves to withstand these moments. That means putting ourselves in awkward situations. Like me, on the train with that woman whose eye makeup was so incredible. I couldn't figure out how to tell her, or if I should, but I got good practice at sitting in uncertainty. Finally, when we talk about authenticity at work, we have to remember that there are guardrails. We can be as authentic as feels prudent while still remembering that we are part of a team or cohort in the office. We're in it together. And speaking of being in it together, it's time for another book segment with our friend Scott Olster. Hey, Scott, how are you?
Hey, Jesse. Doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I set the intention to read a book every week this year.
Awesome.
Yeah, amazing. I haven't done it.
Well, it's early.
It is early.
The year is young.
But I've shifted the intention a little bit, which is to invite you in here more regularly to tell us about the books I should be reading.
Oh, sure.
So what are you reading right now?
These days, I just finished a book called Legacy by an author named Uche Blackstock. And Uche Blackstock is a doctor. She trained in emergency medicine. She followed in her mother's footsteps. So her mom was one of the few African-American women to go to Harvard Medical School. And Uche and her sister both followed her to Harvard Medical School.
Wow. And are they roughly our age? Like,
yeah, I would say Uche is probably in her early 40s at this point.
Yeah.
And for her, like, just the figure of her mother. Her mother was this huge inspiration. She lost her mom at 19 years old while she was actually an undergrad at Harvard. So this is an exceptional family.
Tell us about the message of the book for listeners in particular.
So the book is a memoir by Blackstock where she discusses how much her mother meant to her, but also how she struggled to follow in her footsteps due to just the sheer weight of being a Black woman in a career like medicine, trying to make a difference in patients' lives in an environment and in a field that, for the most part, is stacked against Black people.
Yeah.
And it's pretty astonishing and eye-opening just how much and how deep the systemic challenges go when it comes to treating Black Americans in the U.S. healthcare system. And it goes to how doctors are trained. It goes to even how devices are created, like something as simple as a pulse oximeter, what measures oxygen levels, super, super critical during the COVID time, right?
Right.
So even something like a pulse oximeter actually has bias built into it. This comes from the book. I didn't know this, but the readings on a pulse oximeter trend higher for Black people because of the way it was designed. Now, during a time like COVID, that means that overall Black people were not being flagged for COVID concerns because of this adjustment in the readings. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. That's
just one small medical device. So imagine that through a system, I would imagine.
Exactly. And so for her, she went into the field trying to follow in her mother's footsteps. She went and worked actually at the same hospital as her mother for some time in Brooklyn. And for her, it was this eye-opening experience of just how challenging it is to make a difference, even when you desperately want to.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Scott, you know I'm going to ask, is there one detail that you can leave us with that you will remember from this book?
So the thing for me that I take from the book is that despite all of these incredible, these formidable challenges that she describes so effectively, while she was losing her mother, she asked her mom you know, since I'm not going to have you around for so long, what are some things that you'd want me to keep in mind? And her mom, without missing a beat, said, always put yourself first. No matter what, even when you have babies, put yourself first. And for me, you know, given the career that she had, some of the struggles that she had trying to, like I said, trying to make a real difference, that concept of self-preservation really, really rings true. It's so critical, no matter how hard your job is, how hard you're trying to do work in a great way, you do have to keep yourself and your needs in mind as well.
Yeah, I love that. Well, thank you, Scott. We'll look forward to the next time.
Yeah, of course.
I hope you'll join us this week for Office Hours. We'll talk about how we embrace our awkwardness. How did you make it through an intensely cringe moment of your own? What did you learn about yourself? We'll go live on Wednesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern from the LinkedIn news page. If you have trouble finding us, email us at hellomonday@linkedin.com and we'll send you a link. If you want to hang out with us even more, be sure to join the Hello Monday group right here on LinkedIn. Hello Monday is a production of LinkedIn News. Sarah Storm produces our show with help from Lolia Briggs. It's sound designed and engineered by Asaf Gadron. Our theme music was composed just for us by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our contributor, Michaela Greer, helps us power through our awkward moments. Enrique Montalvo is our executive producer. Dave Pond is head of news production. Courtney Coop is head of original programming. Dan Roth is the editor-in-chief of LinkedIn. And I'm Jesse Hempel. I'll be back next Monday. Hope you will too. Thanks for listening. It's almost your birthday. You are almost a leap.
You're 42. Yeah, no, I wasn't born on a leap.
But you edge up right against the possibility of it.
Yeah, and all my leap friends celebrate on my birthday. So.
Oh, that's real. Do you have more than one
leap
friend?
I do. Bizarrely.
I don't even think I know a leap.
No, I have at least four. Well, one is a set of twins, so that's sort of cheating. I got a 2-for-1.
Yeah.
And then I think I have about one or two others.